Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's up, everyone? Derek Evers and Chris Robbins with Nothing Urgent. And if I'm talking faster and introducing us faster than I normally would, it's because there is a lot of stuff happening.
A lot of news.
Ton of news.
Yeah.
Are you on?
Now you are.
You
didn't miss anything. I just said big news, a lot of news.
A lot of news. It's a crazy day today. And this week, actually, these past 2 weeks. We talked a little bit about Paula Deen, so we don't have to talk about her, but...
Let's not speak of her again for a while.
A lot of major news happening. I mean, maybe you want to.
A lot of news from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court invalidated California's Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage, and then they also invalidated the Defense of Marriage Act, which is the federal law prohibiting gay marriage, which is a huge deal. So now lots of gay married couples will have federal recognition. You know,
yeah,
joint income taxes. You can marry someone overseas or who's from overseas, and they can get a green card. There's a lot of, you know, estate tax, you know, mishmash. But to not complicate the issue, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal, and that's obviously the bigger portion of it is the rights that the spouses now get that they weren't legally recognized within the federal courts,
right?
State courts, some of them. Some of the states. How many are there that recognize it?
If California rolls back Prop 8, which they're expected to, then 30% of the country will be living in a state that recognizes same-sex marriages, which is a lot.
You know what was really interesting? And I we're going to have a guest on later.
That's right. Who are our guests?
Well, we have Dirty Beaches that will be coming on shortly.
After our first guest, who is Bob O'Neill, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Law,
and
who
he's
will
gonna,
be speaking about the
yeah, he's gonna issue. He's gonna try to help us understand all of this. But I was kind of interested to see that Sonia Sotomayor actually, I think I'm saying that right, the most recent appointee, she actually voted against the repeal of what's the one, the California one?
Prop 8.
Prop 8.
That was like a little bit of a technical ruling. It was a weird majority, 5-4. And Chief Justice Roberts actually wrote that opinion. So that's like a little, there's like technical reasoning for that.
Yeah.
And it was less broad of a ruling as the DOMA ruling. But we're going to get into that.
We will get into that. I mean, we've all, it's I mean, there's so much, it's like we don't even have time to get into matters like Aaron Hernandez getting charged with murder.
Right. Or Edward Snowden sort of playing a really crude version of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, basically juking out a whole plane of journalists who are like looking for him.
That is pretty amazing, actually. That part.
He's holed up in like the Moscow airport, which, you know, how long can you browse the Hudson News? You know, how long can you physically look at all of the Joel Osteen books inside of Hudson News before you just, you know, go insane?
And now Russia is giving him asylum. Isn't that the case?
I don't even know. I've been so immersed in other things. It's been a busy week, as you say.
I know it has been. You've been immersed in BuzzFeed lists about public schools.
Let's not talk about that. But yeah, no, it's weird. And it's all happening at once. And usually summertime is very slow, you know.
Yeah. Again, you're the one to speak to this more than I am. I'm the music guy, after all. But isn't this the time? I mean, don't they usually hold session around this time?
This is their last. This is their last period of time when they announce their opinions before they go home. They're like teachers, and they get to knock off for the summer.
Yeah, they get summer vacation. But is it rare that they have this many big rulings all at once?
No, they usually hold a bunch till the very end, right? Because I mean, you know, it's sort of, it's not a last minute thing, but it's like they're formulating their opinions and they're formulating their decisions up to the very end, you know. So,
and they punted on the case of the
what do you mean?
they sent it back down to the lower appellate courts, the one in Texas about going to school, minorities.
Affirmative action.
Affirmative action, that's the word I'm looking for.
Yes.
So they didn't rule on that. They did rule on the Voters' Rights Act.
Right. Which was, you know, again, the 5-4 majority, Kennedy sort of making the difference in both that case and the DOMA federal case.
It's very interesting that he went against?
He voted to strike down the provision of the Voting Rights Act that creates a formula which certain states and counties and areas would have to submit any changes in their voter laws to the federal government. This is really exciting stuff. But it's very important for voting rights. But they left in the provision that they had to clear it with the federal government, which essentially makes no sense. So that whole sort of section of the law is invalid. And Congress passed that law 6 times, I might add. So that's interesting that they can do that. And then, you know, in the same, I don't know. It's interesting that Scalia would say that that's okay, but then get all angry when, you know, DOMA is overturned.
Right, right. Well, this is some heavy stuff.
Very heavy. Let's bring on our guest.
Yeah, I think we have to let people know that that we'll get a little bit more lighthearted in the
second half of the session
when Alex, aka Dirty Beaches, comes in. But I think Bob is on the phone right now.
Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Excellent.
Thank you for joining us. And as we mentioned before, Bob is a professor emeritus at the University of Virginia School of Law, former president of UVA, and used to clerk on the Supreme Court, right?
That's correct. I clerked for Justice Brennan in 1962, which now seems like ancient history.
So you were sort of around when the Voting Rights Act was passed, no?
No.
That was 65?
It passed in 1965. We had several cases in which the court very much did not want to render a constitutional decision with respect to any aspect of civil rights.
Right.
But very much hoped and eventually was delighted that Congress, under the leadership really of Vice President, later President Johnson, did step up and take on that task, thus leaving the court simply to applaud what Congress had done.
Right. So did the gay marriage ruling surprise you at all?
Not really. Justice Kennedy and I were classmates. In fact, we sat next to each other for an entire year of constitutional law at the Harvard Law School. And most of what Justice Kennedy does, things that I applaud, as I certainly did in this case, and things like the voting rights, which I'm not quite as enthusiastic about, but I recognize that he is very much his own person. He focuses closely on the particulars of each issue. Some people, I think, well, he's going to split the difference.
Right.
Sometimes it looks as though he's splitting the difference. In this case, I think, in fact, he took a rather conservative view with respect to the Voting Rights Act and basically left the preclearance procedures intact, but without the valid coverage formula, which was struck down. There's really a sections 4 and 5 are essentially meaningless,
right?
Until and unless Congress steps up and decides to amend it, which I think, given the partisan situation, is very unlikely. So basically, the Voting Rights Act is gone. On the other hand, when it came to the defense of marriage, that's where Tony Kennedy stepped up very strongly. It was exactly 10 years to the day since his remarkable opinion about sodomy laws in Lawrence versus Texas. So this is a kind of a replay, and he's extremely sensitive to personal rights, the rights of families, the rights of young people, in all those areas. I think he has just reinforced today what he did 10 years ago in striking down the sodomy law.
Right. And he sort of made an interesting comment back in March. He was giving a speech, and he was saying that, you know, these sort of issues shouldn't depend on, you know, what nine unelected people from a narrow legal background have to say. But really, it sort of depends on one person in a lot of these rulings, and that's him. Is that how the court is supposed to work? Or, I mean, does Justice Kennedy have too much power in a sense?
Well, he is, of course, not the first person who has held the swing vote. Justice Powell, in the earlier affirmative action or race-sensitive admissions cases, Justice Powell was the tiebreaker. Later, Justice O'Connor, 10 years ago also, was the tiebreaker with respect to race-sensitive admissions. Now it's Justice Kennedy. That's it's a difficult position to maintain. It's easier, probably, for people who are clearly on one side, as Justice Scalia is, or on the other side, as Justice Ginsburg clearly is. Some ways it's easier for them. Not that they don't work through the issues carefully, because they do, but they're predictable. The problem with the challenge for Justice Kennedy is that he's never entirely predictable. Although I think, as with Justice Powell and with Justice O'Connor, there is a kind of ethos about Justice Kennedy's reasoning and analysis that makes me comfortable. Maybe that's because I'm an old friend and a classmate, but I feel very comfortable.
And, you know, it's interesting because do you think that you said earlier that he bases his decisions, you know, on the case and solely looking at the case, but he has to be aware of that the whole country is sort of looking and branding these decisions with one label being either conservative or being liberal. Do you think that he and the other justices sort of take a step back and say, well, you know, we took out the Voting Rights Act, so we'll give them gay marriage, or we did this, so we'll swing the balance the other way? Do you think any of that is going on, or how much of that plays in their decisions?
I would say little, if any. Background is always helpful. He grew up in the Sacramento Valley, really lived in Sacramento. His father, who died very shortly after we graduated from law school, his father was essentially the representative lobbyist, I guess one might say, of the California wholesale liquor industry, and had a very lucrative practice, which Tony then took over long before he became a federal court of appeals judge or eventually became a Supreme Court justice. I have exchanged views. We used to go on programs in which we were typically on the opposite sides on very volatile political issues in the California legislature in Sacramento. Mm. And from that experience, I got a sense that he is an extremely savvy, practical, feet on the ground kind of person. And as I said earlier, he is very much his own person, but that is not a position which leaves him without guiding principles and transcendent values, of which he is very much conscious.
Right. So in that sense, some people are saying this isn't necessarily a victory for states' rights, but they point to some of his language that he uses in his opinion, saying that the DOMA, quote, humiliates tens of thousands of children now being raised by same-sex couples, end quote. They point to that language and say this isn't so much a victory for states' rights as it is for gay marriage. Would you agree with that? Would you agree that
And for individuals, for families, I don't think he would ever be comfortable using a phrase like family values.
Right.
But he is a person for whom family life, he's an active lay Catholic, is a person who really cares about families, his own for starters, but families in general. And I think that is very much part of his context.
Right. Justice Scalia obviously read his dissent from the bench, and it was very acrid as usual, and he basically said that this sort of opens the gates for people to challenge laws prohibiting gay marriage in other states, and that they will soon fall. Do you think that's the case? Are we going to see that happen?
No, and I think the same could be said with respect to the Fisher decision and the court's continuing commitment to diversity as a value in the admissions process. There's an article today which suggests that now groups on both sides are going to be challenging admissions policies and even admissions decisions. I don't think that's likely. I think in all of these areas, including with the possible exception of voting rights, there I think it's a little fuzzy, but certainly with respect to race-sensitive admissions and a marriage, family life, I think it is unlikely that there will be a barrage of challenges. Partly, it's just too expensive right. to institute litigation these days. It takes a long time, it takes a lot of money, and there is no guarantee of a successful or satisfactory outcome. So I tend to discount in both areas the probability of increased litigation.
Sort of shifting gears, I know you're an expert on the First Amendment and First Amendment law. I wanted to talk a little bit about the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and how Representative Peter King from New York is calling for some of the journalists who helped make his revelations known, called for them to be prosecuted. And even David Gregory sort of raised that possibility on Meet the Press on Sunday. What are the ramifications of, you know, asking for journalists to be prosecuted for something like this? And, you know, what effect does it have on people who might come forward in the future?
Unfortunately, I can't respond because my middle son, David, is the assistant to the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. So I just have to pass on that one.
Well, fair enough. Interesting. Derek, did you...
Anything else I'd be happy to take on, but you can understand that that's... sensitive issue.
Oh, yeah, of course. Derek, did you have anything to add? You've been sitting there patiently and quietly.
Well, no, I was just, you know, I find this all really interesting because, you know, Anthony Kennedy, for all the things that he's ruled on, it's now kind of, they're saying that basically this will be his legacy, that these rulings on, in this case, same-sex marriage, or like you mentioned, the rulings in Texas, and I believe Colorado was the other ruling. This will kind of, you know, cement his legacy, and I just wonder if you have any thought on that. Is that kind of how you think he'll be remembered?
I think so. I think there's a lot more that is likely to follow. I just gave you a 30 or 15-second anecdote, which I think you'll appreciate. He called me because he was looking for law clerks on the Ninth Circuit just after he had his confirmation hearing for the Court of Appeals. And there were only two senators. Senator Eastland was the chairman of the committee. This is way back. And as Tony reported, he said Senator Eastland had only one question. Said, did you have a satisfactory flight, Mr. Kennedy, to Sacramento? He said, well, Senator, actually, I had a terrible flight. It's the first time in my life I've really been sick to my stomach on an airplane. Senator Eastland smiled and said, do any other members of the committee have any questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Kennedy, and have a good trip back to Sacramento. That he would tell a story like that. I mean, we're good friends, but even so, that he would tell a story like that. The other story that I like to tell is that when his confirmation, as you know, there have been several unsuccessful attempts to get people on the Federal Court of Appeals and ultimately the Supreme Court. And Tony was the first person that really seemed satisfactory to all concerned. I had a dinner meeting once with the NAACP Executive Committee of the Sacramento Valley, and they, to a person, said, you know, Tony Kennedy is the only Republican for whom we would have stood up on issues of race, and related matters. But we were solidly in his camp because he's just different. And I thought, this is long before his legacy evolved. Someday I'm going to write an article about Tony Kennedy, adding some things that I'm sure he remembers, but probably a lot of others don't.
It's just a
very striking person and someone for whom I have the greatest admiration.
That's so interesting. You wouldn't think that, a lot of conservatives wouldn't think that he was nominated by Reagan, and, you know, indeed the former Justice Stevens was a Republican appointee. What does it say that these Republican appointees sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like liberalize their views as they mature on the court?
Well, they do, and if you're looking for a contrary experience, take Justice White, who never liked to be called Whizzer. He preferred to be called Byron. Justice White essentially moved to the right. He was viewed as a very liberal labor lawyer when he was Secretary of Labor. His record at the court is much more mixed. So I think it's not just people who move in one direction, but also people who move in the other direction. And I think the best example is Justice White.
I think it's very interesting because, you know, you get a lot of people that I think they look to someone like Kennedy whose votes can kind of go in either direction. And there's actually a form of respect that comes with that, because you don't want someone who's so idealized that they can't swing one way or the other. I think the one thing I want to end with and wanted to ask you is, you know, we kind of have this feel-good feeling of what's going to happen with DOMA or what the next steps are, but where do we go with the Voting Rights Act? Like, what is the what's going to happen?
It depends largely on whether there is any momentum in Congress to enact a new coverage formula to determine which jurisdictions have to apply for preclearance. Given the current split between the two houses and the unusually partisan division that seems to plague the Congress, I am afraid that there just won't be momentum enough from both houses to create a new coverage formula. And that means essentially that the Voting Rights Act collapses by default.
And if I could get you to speculate at all, what does that mean for voting across the board? What does that mean for, you know, as a result on the American public?
Well, I think it's less drastic than it may seem. I think enormous changes have been made. But there are still important issues with respect to voter IDs, for example, and other aspects of the registration process. Those will be scrutinized under state law. There are very limited things that the Justice Department can still do. But with the preclearance, and the preclearance process can go on, but if there's no coverage formula, there's really nothing to preclear. So until there's a new coverage formula, I think it's not going to be a happy day for voting rights.
Well, ending on somewhat of a somber note.
yes, indeed. I think that's the one sort of downside or dark side that we have to recognize.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Bob. I really appreciate it.
The insight it's easy for me to say that you are probably the most knowledgeable person that we've interviewed on this show.
Well, I very much enjoyed it. I'm sorry. Dick, as you know, is already on his way to the Greenbrier for the Fourth Circuit Conference, which he always attends, and he always does the wrap-up speech on the major Supreme Court decisions. And no one does it better than Dick Howard, as I know, because we've been friends for 52 years.
Well, we wouldn't want to take him away, but you were an apt and ample substitute, so thank you so much for your time
glad
and your knowledge.
Glad to be able to join.
All right. Take care, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Right. Bye.
That was, Bob O'Neill, Professor Emeritus, University of Virginia.
I love that the first thing he drops is that he went to school with, or he was classmates
he's good friends
with the person who just made probably the largest ruling in Supreme Court,
one of the
recent years.
Yeah.
And
that he couldn't answer the Snowden question because his son-in-law had a there's a conflict of interest.
Yeah,
there.
That is. I was gonna jump in and actually say now that is a conflict of interest to say the least. There's, it's very, you know, we talk about conflicts of interest in like the music industry or something like that, and you laugh now. You know, it's like I was like, oh, how could that website make a video for that artist and consider that editorial? And then you're like, yeah, that's not a real conflict of interest.
He was very polite about it, and actually, I'm sort of surprised because he is known for his. I mean, he literally is a First Amendment scholar first and foremost. So
yeah,
bummer.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's. I mean, like you said, I'm sure he has an opinion on it. So.
That's very true.
Well, that was very exciting.
And now to the second half of our program.
Yeah, we'll be talking with Alex from Dirty Beaches. I don't know if he's here yet. Is he?
Should we?
Oh, we got the thumbs up from Joe.
Let's play some start.
Yeah, we're gonna play some music. We're gonna play some music first, which we will obviously play some Dirty Beaches before we get in. Then we're gonna have Alex come in. And, yeah, we'll try to, well, we should say, that was a lively, I mean, like, we were talking about, you know, DOMA, you know, being struck down, which was signed into law by
President Clinton.
Exactly. There's a lot of, like, weirdly right-leaning laws that he put in, that he, like, signed in.
Yeah, you know, it's politics. It's politics, baby.
It is politics. Anyway, this is Casino Lisboa by Dirty Beaches, and hopefully, well, definitely, we'll be sitting with Alex in about 5 or 10 minutes.
Stick around.
This special program was brought to you by TechServe, New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, serving creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built a solid reputation in their expertise in technology, sales, and service. Visit them on the web at techserve.com or in New York City at 119 West 23rd Street. Learn more about their in-store classes and incredible insider program. Make stuff happen. TechServe.
Wow, that was a really, really good segue. It really segued out of Casino Lisboa, which I need to clarify. I didn't play that first. I played Belgrade first, which went into Casino Lisboa. But that's okay, because we got the man who is behind these songs, Alex Zhang Hongtai. Am I saying that correctly?
Zhang Hongtai.
Yeah. A.K.A. or P.K.A., I guess. Dirty Beaches.
Yeah, P.K.A. I never like people who use P.K.A., personally.
But isn't that for, like, one person?
Yeah, I know, but it's just strange.
Do you have a preference, Alex?
No.
No. I didn't think you would. Well, before I, you know, before we ask you any hard-hitting questions like where you stand on DOMA, I don't know if you remember this, but about 5 or 6 years ago, I like to bring up good memories in my history. We were doing a CMJ show with Art Fag and Zoo at Don Pedro's, mm-hmm. and I remember Mario Odonia coming up to me and being like, "We have to get this guy on the bill. We have to get this guy on the bill." And you played like a really amazing but probably about 10-minute set because we had, I think, 8 bands playing that night or something like that.
Yeah, I remember it.
That was a fun night.
That was very fun.
Yeah.
I think I puked in the parking lot afterwards.
A lot of people do that at Don Pedro's.
Yeah. They're lucky if they make it out.
You were the first. Yeah, at least you made it out.
Well, my birthday, I spent a birthday there one time, and I ended up doing it at the we were doing the tickets at the door, and mm-hmm. I did that at the door, so... You're one step. You're much better than me. You made it outside the building. But thank you for making, you know, coming in and taking time.
Thanks for having me.
And you're in town. You're playing shows in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're trying to these shows that you're doing in New York, they're much more collaborative.
Yeah, it was because I couldn't fly my band from Berlin to here. So instead of copying out or saying no, I decided to just collaborate with my New York peeps and.
So now you are full time a band now? Like you perform with a band as opposed to
All moved to Berlin.
Okay,
yeah, from Montreal. Yeah,
but prior you were performing as a one piece.
Yeah, by myself. Yeah.
So is this something new with the new record? New records?
Yeah, totally. Because over the past few European tours, I was touring with my current backup band, and they also helped me write this new album. So we're writing together like as a real band now.
So Berlin, man, what, how is it?
Yeah, what's the appeal?
Cheap rent, beautiful babes, nice canal, just like kind of like New York, but German.
Yeah, I you know, you hear a lot of people talk about Berlin like it's almost like a, I don't want to say an alternative to Brooklyn or something of that nature. I just can't get is there a lot of like, I don't know, it's probably a bad topic to bring up, but is there a lot of like Aryan white males walking around very stiff?
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of how I envision it.
But it's also got a lot of different people from all over the place, you know, from Europe and from South America, from Africa, from Asia.
So so you said cheap rent, but you were living in Montreal prior to that, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is also pretty cheap.
So what was it was just on a whim sort of thing, or?
Yeah, I mean, at first I realized I was just trying to escape being the Anglophone minority in Quebec, and only to switch that with German. but I'm enjoying it there.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's probably a topic that you've discussed a few times, especially with an album that kind of lends credo to the fact that you're somewhat of a drifter, somewhat mm-hmm. of a nomad. But I'm actually kind of jealous of that lifestyle. I'm not going to lie. Do you find that, is that something you enjoy? Like, do you see yourself ever settling down?
I mean, yeah, eventually I would love to. I was actually talking to my friend in New York who's really overworked, and he was just like, man, I need to reset. I need to go out and just, and I'm telling him, I'm looking at him like, I'm resetting like every week.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of, I'm on the opposite side of the spectrum, so I'm not really doing any better than he is.
Right.
I think something in the middle would be great, where you're just like, there's some sense of balance.
Right.
You know, you can go out and explore and come back, have a home base to return to. Whereas now I'm moving from sublet to sublet. Like, every month I change an apartment.
And that's, is that basically because you're touring all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't want to pay rent when we're on tour. Yeah. So, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I also noticed, it's kind of like, I'm veering all around and not really talking about the album yet, which we'll get to. But are all the photography on your blog, is that all you?
Yeah.
You take some really amazing photos.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, no, it's that, again, I feel like, you know, we should be sitting here, but I was kind of blown away by your photos and found them to be really intriguing. Is that something that you've ever considered, like, doing an exhibit or anything like that?
No, I don't think I'm that good. I just take it on my iPhone and just, like...
You capture really good moments in time. Obviously, there's the ones where you're around other bandmates and stuff like that, mm-hmm. but there's just a lot of really great, like, scenic type of shots.
Yeah, there's definitely... I mean, we're really lucky to go see all these places, and I didn't want to be that kind of jaded, you know, working musician who's right. just, like, sitting in the green room and, like, waiting to play and not go out and not talk to anyone. Like, when we go to places, I just walk around all the time.
And where's your most, like, what is the most, I guess, picturesque or, you know, beautiful place you've been?
Oh, man, there's so many. I really love, like, the Balkans in Eastern Europe. Asia was crazy, too. Like, South Korea, I've never been there.
Yeah.
Thailand was crazy, too. Just, like, so different than North America and any other places I've been.
And how were you accepted in Asia?
It was
being
great.
Asian. I mean, is it something like where they look at you as kind of like someone that they look up to?
There was these two encounters I had in South Korea that was really memorable. It was like these two South Korean dudes who just finished like their military service, and they all had the pompadour and leather jackets. And I was like, oh, cool, man. I'm sorry, I don't have the pompadour anymore. I shaved my head. <It's> like,
yeah, you just, went military style.
Yeah, I was like, I'm just going back to high school mode. But they were just like, yeah, we just got out of our military service. We just saw, like, a concert poster and like with an Asian guy, you know, that, like, does rock and roll. We looked you up on Google. And they were just like, yeah, we just wanted to go to a rock concert. But after the show, obviously, we were, like, playing more like a noise show.
Right, right.
And they were... Even though they couldn't comprehend the music, but they were just like, I like what you do. It, you know, it's like very moving.
Yeah.
For me, I just finished like military. And he was like, thank you. I needed like release. That kind of, like, he's just like struggling with his English.
Yeah.
But I could understand what he was trying to say. That really moved me because he was just like, I connected with it in a physical level. And he just like, he was so frustrated, you know, in some way, and just and that's like one of the greatest like encounters you can have with concert goers.
Yeah, no, that's really amazing.
Your shows when you're performing by yourself are like really, really, to me, like pretty powerful stuff, and it seems like you're channeling a lot of energy. When you're playing with a band, is that change? I mean, are you still sort of, I don't want to say that you're in a trance, but you're sort of in a
very
trance.
Cathartic.
Yeah. I'm definitely like, I have to switch on this mode where I don't think about the show. I don't think about the crowd in front of me. Then it makes it easier for me, as if I'm just practicing or something. And then you can go somewhere else. I think it's like for an hour or 2 hours, I can just be gone.
Right.
And then hopefully, you know, take whoever is willing to come along for the trip and just like, trip out for a bit and then come back to reality and then just be like, that's like the balance, you know, the release and come back to reality kind of thing.
Right. Was it like that too when you were recording stuff by yourself without a band? Like, did you just sort of need to explore those places by yourself and then get that out? And how is that different from, you know, writing songs with other people? Like, how are you?
Yeah, I mean, when you're by yourself, it's kind of like when you perform, you have to kind of pour gasoline on your soul and then like light it on fire on stage so people won't talk over you because you're so quiet and just trying to play your songs. But when you're in the band mode, like volume wise like literally people will have to pay attention to you because you're so loud, and it takes a lot of weight off my shoulders. And writing with other people is great too, because when you find the right collaborators, it's kind of like having brothers, and which is always better than just working by yourself. It gets hard, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I have like people to share the weight.
Now you're also very prolific. You put out a lot of music. I know you just put out two albums in one.
Yes.
Okay, before we move on to my next question, I'll just ask you, what was the concept between splitting these two up?
Actually, they were conceived at the same time, and the initial idea was to have like a part one and part two, mm-hmm. kind of like a movie.
Yeah.
And just separate them by release date, because if I were to come, I did edit out a lot of tracks. After compiling them into a double album, I think if I left in all the tracks that I took out, it would have been probably like 2 hours long, which is like way too much.
Yeah. Well, by format style, you know, think about that in the internet age, it's like, when is the format going to matter? You know? I remember Dan Deegan saying one time, he's just waiting for the day when someone releases like, you know, a like 17-hour track or something like that.
Yeah.
Just one, you know. But there was no definitive concept between Drifters and Love is the Devil?
There is. I mean, they're kind of like, I wanted to present one story, but from two perspectives, and show how dramatically different they can be, just on, kind of like touching back on the subjects you guys were talking about, you know, it's just like, it really depends where you stand and how you view the subject. It could be the same topic could be viewed like very dramatically different.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was under the assumption that Drifters is more about kind of your, especially since many of them are, you know, references to cities, kind of mm-hmm. your lifestyle of drifting from city
yeah,
to city.
I mean, it's kind of like an egotistical, like, bullshit, how I want to be perceived, and I'm trying to glamorize my own life, justifying any kind of irresponsible behaviors. And then the other one is, like, real talk.
You know?
It's, like, all instrumental. It's, like, not having any time to spend with your family, failed relationships, far from your boys, not in your comfort zone, you know, surrounded by strangers all the time.
Well, you mentioned family. Do you mind if I ask where your parents live now?
Yeah, my parents moved to Shanghai in China about 10 years ago.
Okay.
So when I want to see them, I have to go there.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unfortunate because I'm not from there. I'm from Taiwan.
Right.
So, I mean, people there kind of treat me differently, and because of my Taiwanese accent when I speak Mandarin.
Right.
And they always ask me these like political questions, like, what's your stance on Taiwan's independence and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I'm just like, I'm just on vacation.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, leave me alone.
But how often do you get to see them? That's got to be tough.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm lucky, twice a year.
Yeah.
If not, probably once a year, once 2 years.
Do you find yourself ever trying to get yourself your tours to kind of route in those directions?
Yeah, like the Asia tour was exactly like that. The band and I, like all of us, we just had a unanimous decision after the tour. We're like, we're gonna go home and spend time with our parents.
Yeah.
And Shub, the guitar player, went to India to see his grandparents, and his parents were there. I went to Taiwan to see my parents, and Bernardino went back to Montreal.
It's your computer.
Is it?
I think so.
We keep hearing.
Don't blame it on Derek. It's always Derek's fault.
It might be, but I don't have anything Derek. Open. You know what it might be? This time page. I'll just close the time page then. Yeah, sorry. It's just, you know, we're trying
Jesus.
To do research on, you know, DOMA.
Jesus.
We have a very international band in general then.
Yeah. I mean, when we go to Europe and other countries, people are like, kind of freaked out, like at the borders and stuff.
Yeah.
And we all show up with Canadian passports. They just kind of like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Like, so let me see. You guys got the drugs from El Salvador and then take it to India and then you go to China, yes? And you come now to Europe to try to sell this. You tell us you're playing a rock and roll band. And it's like,
I wonder if that happens a lot. That'd be really kind of I wouldn't say really good cover. I feel like most bands I tour with in Europe or I hear stories about, they always get searched. So maybe that's a horrible cover.
Yeah, we got searched at every border.
Yeah, I know. The worst cover for drug smuggling is being in a rock band.
Oh, man.
The other question I have, I mean, you, the travel thing, I'm sorry I keep talking about it. It's just something that really intrigues me. Maybe it's just because I'm...
It's okay.
Know,
that's, that's why we're on the radio, so we can explore these issues.
Yes, too. These topics. But so you your visa ran out in America? Is that why you no longer like?
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much. Like I used to live in Hawaii. I grew up in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Went to high school and college there, and then I moved to San Francisco with my band. Then my visa ran out, so pretty much like my whole life kind of stopped because I was so naive, thinking that just, you know, play music, work a shitty job, whatever, you know, hang out with the boys, have a girlfriend. have a shitty apartment, go to the movies, you know, just...
The American dream.
Yeah, the American dream.
The American dream.
Every, you know, early 20s, like, yeah, lifestyle, and it pretty much just stopped, like, and then after that, I had to, like, work really hard and think about what I want to do with my life. And
so if you don't mind me asking, how did you go to high school then? Were your parents in Hawaii as well?
No, just my sister.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I was living with my sister.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, people don't... I mean, it's like... the other reason why it intrigues me is because we, you know, as someone who's here in America or New York, and we see you, you know, you come through town probably twice a year, you know, maybe if you see you at South by Southwest or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't think about something like that. Like, you're... Legally, you can't live here.
Yeah. Actually, I can now.
Oh, can you?
I got a working visa.
Okay, cool.
So, take that.
That has there's a...
What's the situation?
U.S. immigration,
there's the feel-good ending to this story.
How does it work in Germany, though? Like, how long can you stay
there? I got an
artist
visa.
So they have artist visas?
Yeah, that's the cool thing about being North American. Like, for us, like me and you, we can just show up and, you know, be a tourist. And then just be, like, at the end of the tourist stay, you can just be like... I kind of want to stay.
Yeah.
So I looked it up, and then it was just like, you buy German health insurance, you show them your resume, and have enough press, and have basically German professionals in your field who will, like, vouch for you.
Yeah.
And then you go to the interview, and I got everything prepared, and I had everything in little folders, and the German interview... Vera was really impressed, and I had a German to translate, so I got it the day of. And you don't even have to leave the country, you can just stay there and apply for an artist visa and stay.
That's amazing. And is there any limits on that, like years?
It's 1 year.
Okay.
And you have the option to renew
after every year.
After every year.
That's a pretty sweet deal.
I think the second year you have to start paying German tax.
But they get incredible benefits though over there, don't they?
Yeah.
Like, they get, like, month-long vacations for health benefits and stuff like that.
Totally. A lot of people go there too, and everyone's just, like, spending money there.
Yeah. Know?
And they love that. They welcome that.
I remember I went to the Dominican Republic one time, and it was basically, like, American tourists and German tourists who were there on their, like, holiday, basically. Mm-hmm. I just remember saying Scheiße over and over again.
when Derek thinks of Germany, that's what he thinks
of. I could count German, actually. It's a funny story. My grandfather, not funny story, this is not funny at all, but my grandfather was actually a POW in World War II. He was captured by the Germans in Africa and then went all through Europe in, like, the back of a German truck
until
he made it to Germany, where he was eventually imprisoned, but it was right near the end of the war, so he was let go. But, like, he learned all this German because he was German. So, yeah, I remember he taught me how to count in German. That was it.
Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf,
sechs, sieben, acht, nine,
zehn. Yeah.
That's what I used to be able to count higher. Now
do crowds in Berlin? Because, like, New York's really notorious for, depending on the venue, like, everyone's too cool to, like, move or too cool to, like, emote. Basically, is Berlin the same way? Or is there
not at all.
Really?
I think there's an openness in Berlin that I really like. The party scene is also really, really hard. Like, it's really...
A lot of the raver techno scene too, right?
Yeah, and I'm really loving it. Because before that, I always suffer from this North American syndrome where we don't really listen to, you know, like, rave music.
Yeah.
Because there's weird, like, rock and roll dudes. But now it's like, I love electronic music, even though I don't know anything about it.
Right.
But maybe that's why I love it, because I just enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to analyze
things. Exactly.
People are just partying. If you look like you're too high and, like, need help, someone come over and be like, do you need some Wasser? You need some water? And I was like, thank you. Yeah. And people pat you on the back and just, like, leave you alone. Everyone's really respectful. You know, like, hot babes, like, they show up in, like, groups of five. They just dance with each other. They don't want to... And no dudes would be, like, gross enough to, like, go up and grind on them.
Yeah, right. Right.
Everyone's really super respectful. You're just there to dance to 2 p.m. Like, I've never danced until 2 p.m.
That's
a pretty good metaphor for America. America's the country that just grinds up on other countries, and even they don't want to, you know?
Yeah, they don't want
to. It's like, in Berlin, you can just, like, you know, be yourself and relax.
That's interesting, because I have heard a lot about that. Is this, maybe Joe can, maybe we have a sponsorship from the German Tourism Board.
We should go.
Yeah, I know. I'm ready to do that. Well, we've got about a minute left, so I'll take this time to thank you again.
Oh, thanks for coming.
I mean, we're definitely fans, you know, we've, like I said, we've, since that day at Don Pedro's, See, it's all about coming full circle. Since that day at Don Pedro's, we've been.
Can people buy tickets to these shows tonight and tomorrow? Or are they sold out?
Tonight is sold out, I believe. Glasslands is getting close to sold out.
That's tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Friday night. Yeah.
Who are you playing with? Or no?
Yeah. Who are the collaborators?
Yeah. The collaborators for tonight is my friend Joshua Frank. He has a project called Parallel Pyres, and just a really fast, brief background. He's like the opposite of me. He's a Canadian who grew up in India and China, and I met him in China, and then we hooked up in Montreal, just hanging out and playing music. And his little brother, like when he was 16, booked my first Chinese show in Beijing.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're collaborating tonight at Mercury Lounge. Friday, my collaborator is Heather Pearls, who's on Ghostly International, and Iola, who plays in this band, this awesome band called Tone Starts Bandit.
Yeah, yeah.
Who,
no, definitely.
Who we were on tour with in Russia.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So are you going to... are these going to be like songs off your album?
No, not at all.
Gonna be,
it's it... more just kind of like we come together and hang out and jam and kind of try to reinterpret what I'm supposed to sound like. So it's very loosely based on Dirty Beaches. So, but I think New York can handle that.
Yeah,
if there's any city that would appreciate this kind of like one-time collab sets, I think New York is hip enough or nice enough and cool enough to handle the weird shit.
And the last question I'll ask you, what are you going to do on your day off? What are you going to do tomorrow?
Unfortunately, more press.
Well, then we won't... That's a great way to... Because then we won't keep you any longer.
Before I go, I just want to show you this picture.
Okay.
Sorry that no one can see it.
Yeah, no.
Here you go.
That's really good.
Coming
it's
back.
A picture of... It's... Derek, can you describe it? It's a picture of America... I guess sodomizing or getting sodomized
by
Canada.
You know what the interesting part of it is? Where America is getting sodomized is right where I grew up, actually. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and that is where the sodomy happens, I guess. It is true, though. We are very Canadian in Buffalo, so, like, you know, we get that Canadian influence.
A lot of fluids. A lot of fluids running over the border.
Well, with that...
That's very apt.
With that, Alex... Thank you very much.
Thank you,
thank you for coming by. And I'm sure you'll have amazing shows, but
cheers, man.
Upward and onward.
Thank you.
All right, that's it.
Yeah, thanks to Bob O'Neill. Thanks to Alex. Thanks to everyone.
Very deep, and it's been a good show.
See you next week.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.